It's all things life and love with an emphasis on healthy relationships. It's Real Talk with Dr. Rick on The Truth. Dr. Rick deals honestly and openly with issues affecting your relationships from a Christian perspective. And now, licensed relationship therapist and marriage coach, Dr. Rick Marks.
Welcome to Real Talk with Dr. Rick of Live the Life Ministries. Live the Life Ministries is a Northeast Florida community marriage and family initiative ministry where we seek to strengthen marriages and families because we believe that strong marriages and strong families are the bedrock of any community. And we know through world history, as marriage and families go, so go nations. And we believe that the strength of a nation and the strength of the church, the strength of a community lies in the strength of its families, and in the families in particular, the marriages. And so we are committed to making sure individuals are healthy, strong, mature, that couples who are dating are doing well in their dating so they have good marriages, and we enrich and help troubled marriages as well through our different programs. You can check us out at livethelife.org. That's livethelife.org. Now, if you have a question or something you'd like to submit to us, contact me at email, realtalk@livethelife.org. That's realtalk@livethelife.org. Or you can find me on Facebook at Real Talk with Dr. Rick on Facebook. That's on Facebook, Real Talk with Dr. Rick. Okay, we're going to jump right in. It is now 2019. That's right, it's 2019. And we have just gotten through the holidays. And we talked last week about probability and possibility and what does that look like. If you have a passion, how do you make your passions and your dreams real, all right? Many people pray and ask the Lord for things, but they do not believe he's going to answer it. Jesus said, when you pray and ask, ask believing that it has already been answered. You want to know why a lot of people don't get their prayers answered? Because they didn't believe it was going to happen. And because they did not believe it was going to happen, it didn't happen. Because you reap what you sow. It's the law of attraction. If you sow doubt, you reap doubt. He said, pray believing that it'll already be happening. That means you got to be able to understand that when he says it's going to happen, it's going to happen. And when you ask for something, believe it's going to be what you want. Because if you're asking correctly, you're asking in accordance with his will for your life. All right? Now, we do want to spend a little bit of time today moving then to how do we create the probability or the possibility for the marriages that we want. Now, January typically in marriage from a therapy world is known as divorce month. That's right. January 1st is usually known as divorce day. Why? Because that's the day people go and file for divorce. Why? Because during the holidays, they keep thinking, well, I'm not going to file right now. I want to keep things together for the kids, right? And or they have hope that maybe something will get better during the holidays, you know, because there's a little bit of hopefulness going on in your home and in society at large. You can feel it, you know, walking through shops and you got the lights and the music. There's always a sense of anticipation. And some people take that anticipation hoping that the marriage will get better. Course by itself, right? And we know that won't work. You got to be intentional about that. But they hope that something will happen. And then when it doesn't happen and January comes along and New Year's is over and then you realize nothing's changed. I don't feel different. And next thing you know, they're filing for divorce. So divorce is always January is a high divorce filing month because they get through the holidays and then they go end it. And we believe that if you were intentional to win that person over when you were dating, then that intentionality needs to stick around all the days of your life, all right? So today we're going to focus on husbands and what you can do intentionally to let your spouse know that you love them, that you value them, and that they matter to you. So before I give some practical insights here, I want to have a conversation about this idea of being intentional and this idea of why is it that over time people become less intentional about their marriage. They let things just kind of happen on their own, and they quit doing the investing. And the answer is pretty simple in my way of thinking, and just offered it as a possibility for you to think about as well. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about the word love for a minute, and then I'm going to translate that into what I really want to talk about why is it we don't really create intentionality in our relationships. And the idea of love is, the word love is grossly misused in culture. All right, let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. I love my wife. I love Luella. I love my children. I love the U.S. military. For those that don't know, I'm a 12-year Navy veteran, and I get to work with the military now. We have contracts with the Air Force Special Forces, and they use our programs. And every month, we get to serve our warriors with the U.S. Air Force. I love the U.S. military, and I love mint chocolate chip ice cream. I've always jokingly said that mint chocolate chip ice cream is the Lord's favorite flavor. There's no doubt in my mind about that. Might be in yours, of course. Now, just think about what I just said. I love my wife. I love my kids. I love the U.S. military, and I love mint chocolate chip ice cream. Do you hear the misuse of the word love there? I mean, Rick, you love mint chocolate chip ice cream and your wife? And the answer is, of course. Really? That's a misuse of the word love. But what if I changed the word love to this word? What difference would it make in how you began to treat each other, serve each other, i.e. love each other, on a regular daily basis? We'll start with John 3:16, a very familiar passage. For God so loved the world that he gave. The giving comes out of the loving. The giving is an action based on the loving. But what if I changed the word love to this word, since we've already realized that the word love is grossly misused in culture today? What if I changed it to this word? What difference would it make in how you treat each other? Here's the word. For God so valued the world that he gave. You see, I do value my wife, and I do value my children. I do not value the U.S. military near as much. And to be perfectly honest about it, I don't value mint chocolate chip ice cream at all. I just love it. You get the idea. You see, now think about it this way. If I was to treat my wife on a regular basis, somewhat consistent, in a way that would suggest to her by my actions that I don't value her, if I demean her, if I'm neglectful, if I'm constantly critical, if I'm not reaching out in ways that says I care about you, if I do that on a regular basis, if I treat them in ways that devalues them on a regular basis, is it not logical and rational that Luella could then argue that I don't love her? Sure she could, because love never ever devalues the object of love. But if you treat someone on a regular basis in a way that devalues them, you understand when you say you love them, that statement has little credibility. Because if you say you love them, then it begs the question, why do you devalue me? Why do you mistreat me? Why do you neglect me? Why do you live for self and not us? You see, there are so many people living for themselves today, and in so doing, you devalue your partner. And when you devalue your partner, they're going to walk out of your life at some point. Now, I'm anti-divorce, but I live in a real world. The reason so many women are leaving their marriages today, and you just notice that women, because it's women who are leaving mostly based on research, it's called walk-away wife syndrome. It's been given a name in culture, men. And the reason their walk-away wife syndrome exists today is because of the men. It's because we're not nurturing. We're not tender. We're not reaching out. We're not doing the things that it takes to send a message, I love and value you. But when you treat someone with value, you've died to self. When you value others, you've moved to humility. When you value others, you're living out of goodwill. When you value others, you're always respectful. When you value others, you operate in empathy and compassion. You see, when I send a message that I value you, then when I say I love you, there's great credibility behind it. Okay? So what happens is, guys, since I'm speaking to husbands today, we quit doing the thing that says to our spouses that I value you, that I love you. All right? And so we need to be able to send a message on a regular basis and do things that says I value you, that you are a value to me, and that is more than just words, folks. That is more than it's also about actions. I will show you my faith by my good works, all right? So what are some things that men that we can do that says to our spouses that I value you, that you are important to me, that I love you? Now, I'm going to give you a little story of one of my mess-ups, okay, for many years, and then I'm going to give some practical ideas. All right, so here's a story. For many years, I used to buy my wife red roses. She was always appreciative. You can get them pretty inexpensive places like Walmart, those kind of things, right? And they're good roses. And so I'd always buy them, and I'd bring them, you know, get them to her, put them in a vase. She'd come home, she'd see them. She was always appreciative. Always appreciative. Until about 10 years ago. About 10 years ago, she came home. I had bought her roses. I was actually proud of myself because she's always liked them. And she came home. She saw the roses in the vase, and she looked, and she smiled. She says, "Oh, you got me roses." And I was patting myself on my back, you know, inside of myself, like, I'm a good husband. See, I'm thinking of her. And then she asked a question of me. Now, when she asked the question, guys, you just know that you're done for, all right? You just know you're done for. And she looked at me and she said, "What color roses do I like?" You feel it right back there in the lower brain. You feel this tension rise. You start to move your neck around a little bit, you know, to kind of warm it out. And you know you got triggered into this defensive posture because you know something's coming. And I looked at her and I said, "Well, apparently I've missed something." And she said, "Missed something? You know, you say you're a good listener." And I put my hand up and I said, "We don't need to go down that road. We teach against those things in our Adventure of the Marriage program. We teach how to regulate your brain and how not to go down low brain ways of communicating." So I put a hand up and I said, "We don't need to go down that road. I said, "But I promise you right here, right now, whatever you say is going to go straight to my rational mind, straight into my limbic brain, and which is the emotional brain, and it's going to stay there and never leave." And here's what she said, almost word for word. She said, "Rick, I appreciate the thought of roses, red roses. However, red roses mean nothing to me. Yellow roses mean everything. I won't tell you again." And guess what? I've been buying yellow roses ever since. Why? Because it's the yellow roses that have value to her, not red. So when you serve your spouse, when you serve your wife, you want to meet the needs in a way that has value to them, not value to you. All right? It's like, guys, when you go and say, "Look, I bought you a brand new skill saw." Yeah, sure. She's not even a carpenter. You know, you didn't get that for her. That's because you value you. You get the idea. So what are some things that we can do that lets our wives know that we love them and value them as a person? Here's some thoughts. Number one, I think it's important for us as men to make sure that we give our wives time off from the home. And what I mean by that is, say, "Hey, why don't you go out with your girlfriends?" If you have children still at home, now I'm at the empty nest, all right? But when you have children home, encourage your wife to get away from the kids, to go do something for her, because she has to be a whole person as well. She needs an identity outside of just being a mom, all right? And so give her an opportunity to go do something away from home. That might be shopping, going out with her girlfriends, visiting her parents. But let her go do some things that rejuvenate her. And you don't do it with ill will, and you don't do it with an attitude. It is a joy to see her thrive in those areas. Because when they can get away and just be them and do the things that they want, be it their hobbies or whatever it is, they thrive. When they thrive, you will thrive. Because the marriage and the family is thriving. All right? So first thing I think of is provide some time off for them away from the home. You step out and get in there and you do some diapers. I mean, I was in seminary when we got pregnant the first time, second and third time. I was in seminary. We had all our kids when I was in graduate school. And I was committed to keeping Luella at home. This is what she wanted. And then the Lord told me, "This is what I want you to do." And I said, "Aye, sir." And so I was working full time and going to school full time. So I was, you know, and yet we didn't use We didn't use, disposable diapers. We used cloth, folks. And I learned how to do cloth diapers and how to clean them and all of that stuff, right? And I did that because I knew it was important for me to be able to do that and not just look at Luella do that. There were times when I was tired and she was tired. And as we got our second one, Madison, and we got our third, she's a mom who's staying home raising three children. Personally, folks, I wouldn't do that. You know, I always jokingly said, I work in a psych hospital before I have to stay home and be a stay-at-home mom. I'm not cut out for that. Luella was, and she thrived there. But that doesn't mean she didn't need time away, all right, or help. So give them some time off at home. Number two, all right, provide some time for your wife to thrive with the children. What I mean by that is make sure you support them with the children. Support her with the children, all right? Support her with the children. If she makes some decision you disagree with, support her. Back her up. Go disagree in private, all right? Make sure she gets to always stay in that mama role and she's respected in that mother role. All right? That means you back some things up. I remember a long time ago, I think Madison was about 8 or 9, something like that. I put her to bed, and I had, she said, Daddy, will you turn on the ceiling fan? And I did, and I was honored to do that, glad to do that for her, because I like a ceiling fan myself. And I gave her a hug goodnight. We prayed, and I went outside of her bedroom, and Luella asked me, did you turn her ceiling fan on? And I said, yeah, I did. Why? She goes, I told her not to turn that ceiling fan on and she couldn't have it. And you, I go, whoa, wait a minute. I didn't undermine you. I didn't know. So I had to go back in, and we had a rule in our home that if mama said it, it's as good as dad saying it. And we didn't let our kids split us in decision making. Now, personally, between you and I didn't agree with Luella. But that wasn't the point. The point was, Madison, mama told you no, you're not allowed to ask me. Okay, so I went back in and undid what I had done because Luella had already told her no. Now, you know, I don't agree with that personally because I like a ceiling fan and I didn't have a problem with my daughter. And so back them up. If they say no about something, you need to stick by that. Even if you disagree, go disagree about those issues in private. So back her up. Support her in front of the children, all right? Do those kinds of things. Give your wife a gift on an ordinary day, all right? Listen, they expect gifts on Mother's Day and their birthdays. What if you got them flowers just because? What if you sent them flowers to their work if they're a working mom? What if you sent them flowers to their work just says, hey, I love you just because? It's those just because things that says I value you. It's those just because gifts that says you matter to me. It's the just because gifts that have no other reason than I love you. Oh, and by the way, there's another thing you can do. It's not just by sending a gift. You know, when we were dating each other, and when you were dating, you think about it. When people are dating, they call each other 2, 3, 4 times a day. I mean, they talk. And then they get married, and down the road of marriage, most couples will still call each other. But when they do call each other down the road of marriage, for most couples, one of them, the one that called, usually asks a question, or the one that received the call will ask a question. It's like this. What'd you want or what'd you need? Now think about it. When you were dating and called each other, who asked that question? The answer is no one. Why is it when we were dating and we called each other 2, 3, 4 times a day, you didn't call because you wanted or needed something, but down the road of marriage when you call because you wanted or needed something, and if I don't want or need something, I don't call. You see, I call well every day to do one word. It's the Hebrew word yada. It means to know. We translate that into the English word intimacy. You cannot have intimacy with someone if you don't want to know them. And so I call and leave her messages if I have to every day to say, I love you. I'm thinking of you. Why? Because it says that that I value her and I'm thinking of her. I want to know. If I come home and she's upset about something, then I need to listen. I need you do your da, all right? And so those are things that you can do on a regular basis. Reach out. Call every day. Leave a message. Not because you want something. It's because you want to say, I love you and I value you. And I'm just thinking about you. And I just wanted to call and tell you. All right? Next idea is make sure you tell her you love her every day. Every day. Not just on the day you got married or once a year on your anniversary. all right, as a reminder. No. Every day we need to hear those words. I love you. I cherish you. You are important to me. We all need to hear those words. Those are words of approval. Those are words of acceptance. When couples get in conflict, they don't know that they're approved anymore. They don't know that they're accepted. Guys, speak those words over them. And I would also add in there, speak it over your kids every day too. All right? Let them know you love and value them. All right? Another idea, men, that you can do to let your wife know you love them is this one. Be silent about their shortcomings. Look, we all have our shortcomings. We all have our challenges. We all have our quirks, if you will. Don't go tell your friends about it. Don't go blast it off over on Facebook or Twitter. Be silent about them. They're human. And respect their humanity and respect their privacy. You wouldn't like it if they did that to you. So why would you want to do that to them, all right? And so if you want to say something critical, then say it constructively. Or the Bible puts it this way. Speak your truth, just do it in love. See, most people in the circles I walk in, they think speaking the truth has the value. That passage in Ephesians 4 is not about the speaking the truth. It's about how you speak the truth. You speak the truth in love. The focus of that passage is not on the speaking of the truth. It's on how you speak the truth. And if you speak a truth not in love, you should not complain about what you get back. Because if you want to sow discord, you will reap it. All right? If you sow criticism, you will get criticism back. Or as one of my mentors said to me a long time ago in my own journey of healing, she said to me, "You want to know why Luella is the way she is with you?" And I kind of quirkily, spouted back at Dr. Gordon. I said, "Yeah, because she's came from an alcoholic home." And Dr. Lori Gordon said to me, "Would you like another alternative?" I went, "Sure." She said, "Have you ever considered that Luella is the way she is with you because of how you are as a way of being?" She said, "What would you expect her to do? Look at how you are. You trained her to be that way." That was sobering. To think that I actually trained Luella to be the way she is around me because of how I am as a way of being. Dr. Phil says it a little bit differently. He just says that we teach people how to be around us. Have you taught your wife to be around you, sir? Have you trained her to shut down? Have you trained her to not open up? Have you trained her to distance herself? Have you trained her to not want to be intimate with you because of how you are as a way of being? And what I learned was, if I trained her to be a certain way, I can untrain her, all right? I can untrain her. And in so sense, quit pointing out her, don't point out so much her criticism, I mean her critical sides, her negative sides. We need to talk about those things, and that's where good communication and problem-solving skills come in. So just as much as you need to not be so critical, you also need to be very appreciative and grateful. You need to point out their strong points. You need to be appreciative of the things that they do for you. You know, when we only focus on the negative, we forget that there's a lot of things that they do that we overlook. You see, I think it was my 19th year of marriage. I'm 34 now. With my 19th year of marriage, I had gone to my bottom dresser drawer in the bedroom. I just got in a shower. And that's where the drawer is where I keep all my T-shirts and underwear. And I opened that drawer to get those out. And I had this, I call it an epiphany, but because I felt it. And as I opened the drawer, I had this experience. And I actually said out loud, and I felt this. I said out loud, "They're always in there." Luella was in the closet, and she stuck her head out. She goes, "What?" I said, "They're always in there." She says, "What are you talking about?" I said, 19 years of marriage, whenever I open this drawer, my T-shirts and underwear are always in there. I realize I take this for granted because if you weren't here, they wouldn't be there unless I made it happen. And I just realized you do things around me all the time that I never even think about. I take them for granted that if death or loss happened today, everything would change. And I'm not ready for that. And I began to be more grateful and appreciative of the things that she does. I told my kids, "Look, you guys were homeschooled, yes, and you made it through college doing well. All of them excelled. But let me tell you something. None of that stuff could have happened getting into school without your mom. Your mama does things for you that we took for granted that I wouldn't have known how to do, but she researched and she did it for them. you know, she does things for me all on a regular basis, washing clothes, keeping the house. I used to take other things for granted. Today I'm appreciative. I say those things. I appreciate this. I appreciate that. I've learned to live fully in the present, and I learned to do that by being appreciative, by being appreciative, being grateful, looking at her strong points. You know, one of my weaknesses is in part of my personality is I tend to not want to deal with conflict. And so, you know, we're at a restaurant somewhere and I didn't get my order exactly right. I'm the type of person that goes, okay, I'll just, you know, I'll eat it medium well. I mean, I'll eat it medium when I really want it well done. Luella goes, no, we're paying for this. We're going to get what you want. You see, I appreciate that about her. Her ability to speak boldly, which is not something I tend to do, okay? It's a personality difference. I like that about her. She's bold and she will speak up. And she does it in a caring way, but she's a lot more bold in that. I like that, and I appreciate that about her. So she has strengths that she has that benefit me. And by the way, I have strengths that benefit her, all right? And so another thing to think about, man, as you're looking at 2019, is when you argue with your wife, keep the heated arguments with your spouse in private. Do not do those things in front of the children. Now, my wife and I, when our kids were growing up, we would argue in front of the kids on minor issues so they could see that mom and dad could argue but still keep being us. That's what we say in our world. They can still stay connected and be respectful to each other. But on the deeper issues that had a lot more emotional intensity, what some people would call crucial conversations, you know, when you have these troubling talks, those things we would do in private because those needed to be done in private away from the kids, all right? And we always wanted to make sure we kept a unified voice in front of them. And I think the last thing is put your wife first. Put your wife first. That means you're going to let – you open the door for her. I got corrected about that a few months ago. She encouraged me to continue to do that for her, and so I've been more mindful about it. Put her first, which requires humility on our part. Our part. There's a lot more things we could talk about and what you could do, but I think you get the idea, guys. If you want in 2019 to build a relationship that says, I love and value you, then you must treat them in such a way that shows that you value them. Remember, we never, ever, ever mistreat the things that we value. You would not throw a diamond away. You would not throw a gold ring away. Why? Because you value that. Your spouse.
WTRJ, Orange Park, Jacksonville. WAYL, St. Augustine. WATY, Folkston, Georgia. Online at ilovethetruth.com.
With SRN News, I'm Bob Agnew in Washington. Many federal workers are frozen out of the jobs, and vacationers are blocked from public attractions as their tax dollars are still paying for them. What's becoming a winter of discontent talks between White House officials and congressional aides are kicking off now. The partial government shutdown is into a third week. Democrats refusing to pony up any money for the president's border wall. He says he's prepared to continue the shutdown to continue to make his case that funding is needed on the southern border. Police say three men were shot and killed in a fight at a bowling alley in Torrance, California last night. That is a coastal Los Angeles suburb where police say they responded to an early morning call of a shooting at the Gable House bowling alley. Witnesses say it all stemmed from a fight between two large groups of people that eventually turned deadly. One witness says he saw the fight devolve into what he called complete chaos. This is SRN News.
For your Saturday afternoon, sunny, breezy, and cool, high 64. Tonight, expect clear skies and rather cold, low 41. Sunday will be sunny and milder with a high 70. Sunday night, mostly clear, some patchy fog after midnight, low 46. Monday, waking up in the fog, but it will be sunny, high 72. And Tuesday, more sunshine, high again, 72.
It's the perfect conversation for the start of the new year. Today on Building Relationships with Dr. Gary Chapman, reframing your life and choosing to do something beautiful.
I got my car going about 80 miles an hour down the freeway. My plan was to smash my car on the viaduct near my home. And as I got that twisted sense of courage that it takes to do such an act, fully intending to kill myself, aiming my car at the viaduct, 80, 90 miles an hour, something miraculous happened. God literally steered that car to safety. And for the first time in my life, I prayed a different kind of prayer, a prayer of desperation. I said, God, if that was you last night, I need to know right now because I'm still going to kill myself.
Welcome to Building Relationships with Dr. Gary Chapman, author of the New York Times bestseller, The Five Love Languages. Our guest today says that within every person is an undeniable longing we can never totally shake. It's that longing we'll be talking about today with a man who grew up an atheist and heard God speak to him when he was a child.
That's an interesting setup to the conversation, and you're in for a real treat and an encouraging conversation about your story, my story, and the story God is writing with each of us.
Chris, I think this is going to be a fascinating discussion because of our guest's background, where he grew up, what he believed, and how God has grabbed hold of his imagination and is using him in this generation. I'm excited about our conversation today.
His name is York Moore. He's a speaker, a revivalist, an abolitionist. We'll find out more about that. He serves as national evangelist for InterVarsity Christian Fellowship USA. York became a Christian from atheism while studying philosophy at the University of Michigan. It makes me smile just to say that. He also has an MA in Global Leadership from Fuller Seminary. York's the author of several books and lives in the Detroit area with his wife and three children. You can find out more about him and his book, which is our featured resource, Do Something Beautiful, at fivelovelanguages.com.
Well, York, welcome to Building Relationships.
What an honor to be on, so thank you so much.
Chris mentioned your background, so before we talk about the book, I want to hear more about your own story, your family you grew up in, and what it was like, what you were taught as a child. Give us a picture of that.
Sure. Well, we weren't your garden variety atheists. In fact, when we were growing up, when we did have a home, we were homeless for quite a while on and off the streets. But when we did have a home, we had a sign in the front of the home that said, "The Moors, the Atheists." And we had a barrel on the side of our house for burning Bibles and other religious propaganda, as my parents would refer to it. So we were steeped in atheism. My parents were followers of an atheistic philosopher named Ayn Rand. She wrote We the Living, Anthem, Atlas Shrugged, a number of different books. In fact, the R in my name, R. York Moore, stands for Rand because I'm named after this atheistic philosopher.
So now, did you have brothers and sisters?
I have four brothers, two older brothers that lived with their dad, and two younger brothers, and the three of us lived with mom. And we left my dad when drugs and alcohol became a part of the picture. So the homelessness was all throughout our early years. But then as drugs and alcohol became a part of the picture, we actually left him and fell into the normal world that you would expect when poverty and displacement are a part of the story, just the early promiscuity, drinking myself, those kinds of things were normal in our lives, living life as if there was no God. And we understand that when we try to do that, it just doesn't work. And it took us a long while to realize that it wasn't working for us. But boy, in those early years, we were committed to the lifestyle that we were living, committed to living life as if there was no God.
Did you at that time think of this as normal, or did you recognize there were other people that felt very differently? As a child, what do you remember in terms of that?
Well, you know, Gary, I think when you're coming up, you don't really know what's normal. You just know your own context. I think children don't really have a grasp on what should be happening. So when you don't eat except for every 1 or 2 days, you think that's normal. When you wear the same clothes every day, or perhaps when you sleep in your car, that might have been out of the ordinary. But you know, you just don't really know what's normal. And so it wasn't until we started going to school. We were homeschooled. I was homeschooled until the fourth grade, not for religious reasons, obviously. And it wasn't until I started going to school that I started to realize if people have normal lives, what we would consider to be normal lives. They sleep in their own bed. They have regular, predictable food patterns and those kinds of things. But it wasn't really until, you know, I was about 10 or 11 that I began to realize the life that we had lived was certainly outside of normalcy. And when it came to being hostile toward God, being very apprehensive about religion, that also I found was abnormal as well.
Yeah. Did you ever think about God or think of God when you were a child?
You know, not much. My parents explained to me at a very early age that God doesn't exist and that people who believe that he exists are kind of making it up. It's a fantasy land. But I remember vividly one particular experience. This was my first experience with God. I'm sitting in the bathtub at the age of six, playing with my rubber ducky in Battleship, minding my own business, when I heard the voice of God. I know that it's going to be hard for some people to wrap their minds around, but I heard God speak, just like I'm hearing you speak to me today. And I just immediately had this sense of connection and was engaging, and I don't know what we were talking about, maybe my rubber ducky and Battleship. I don't remember the content of the conversation. I just remember vividly this back and forth with this presence that was with me in the bathtub. And my parents came in, you know, and said, well, who are you speaking to, Randy York? And I said, well, I'm talking to God. And just the look of disappointment and almost panic as they began to realize that I was breaking the family rules. And they said, well, we thought we explained it all to you very clearly, that there is no God. Mm. That people who believe that there's a God, they're manufacturing it. They're pretending to help them through life or give their lives purpose or meaning. And so, you know, here's the naivete of a five-year-old or a six-year-old. I had let my parents leave the bathroom, and I looked back up at the ceiling because I had to at least finish the conversation that I was engaged in. And I said, well, God, my parents say you don't exist, so I'm going to have to stop talking to you. And, you know, that began the first day of the next 14 years of living life as if there is no God.
Well, coming out of that background, how did you get to college?
Well, that was a miracle in and of itself because my parents, despite the drugs and alcohol, the homelessness, they were artists, starving artists. They were also educators, and so they both had their master's degree. And so education was a big, big deal for us. We were educated homeless people, educated atheists. And so it was never an option as to whether or not I would go to college. And so I just knew that I was on my way. The problem was because of my own drinking and my own womanizing and partying and those kinds of things, I was totally distracted. And so the first couple of years of high school, I managed a straight D average. And I woke up one day in the middle of high school, and I thought, boy, if something doesn't change, I'm going to wind up in prison or on drugs like my dad or homelessness. And none of those options really seemed to be exciting to me. And so I made a decision in the flesh. And, you know, Gary, I think many of our listeners can understand this, that you can choose to live a different kind of life, totally independent of God. You don't need God to make changes in your life. You need God to make eternal changes in our lives. And so I decided that I would apply myself, that I would quit the drinking, that I would change my attitude, that I would really apply myself. And so 11th and 12th grade, I managed a straight A average. Well, 2 years of Ds and 2 years of As gets you not very much. And so I remember, you know, taking all the tests to get into college and getting the results back. And the results would always say, I have a 0% chance of getting into the university of my choice. Zero, like no hope. But I applied anyways. And true story, I got my results back from the greatest university in America, the University of Michigan, go blue. We're playing Ohio State, and we're pretty excited about that. But, you know, I got my results back from the University of Michigan, and I had been rejected. And just totally devastated. We were living at the end of a dead-end street with toxic fumes and about 21 homicides around my immediate area at that time. And it just felt like it was the end of life and hope. And a true story, my mom got in a car and she drove to the university and she went to the admissions office and she literally begged to let me in. And so they let me in under a probationary. I mean, if I burped in class once, I was out on my ear. And but when I went to the University of Michigan, I fell in love, and I've never left. I went to college in 1987, and it's, 2019 now, and I've been on the college campus ever since because I fell in love with the world of the university.
Now, I know many times students don't choose a major right away. Did you choose a major right away, or did that come after a year or so?
No, right away I gravitated toward, I did a couple of degrees, psychology and philosophy, and became an honors student in both of those departments. But here's the thing, I went to discover the meaning of the universe, right? So most people go to college to find a wonderful spouse, to get a great degree so that they can get a great job, and there's nothing wrong with those motivations. I was a little bit unusual because I was looking for meaning and purpose. If there is no God, if in fact there is no God, how do we actually find meaning? What are our lives to be based on? And so I thought out of all of the degrees that I could possibly get, the philosophers would have the best in on the meaning and purpose of, and boy, was I wrong. I mean, you would talk about darkness and despair and depression. Most of the professors were just awful people who were living lives of moral bankruptcy and with no hope. But that's what I studied. I studied philosophy and psychology and really applied myself. And about 3 years into those degree programs, I wrote my honors thesis. And basically, it was my summation that there is no meaning in life, that when we die, we cease to exist, that the best we can ever hope for is to live a pleasurable life, that we can amass as much stuff as we can and have as much experiences as we can, because tomorrow we die. And that's what the Bible tells us, too. The Bible tells us that eat and drink, for tomorrow we die under the sun. If there's no God, this is all really there is. And, after that 3 years, you know, I'll never forget, I had this experience, Gary, where I turned in my honors thesis, and I walked back out to the car after basically coming to the conclusion that there's no God. And I heard that same voice that spoke to me outside in the bathtub. Sweep of air rushed across the parking lot, that cold, crisp December air. And I heard the voice of what I now know to be the Holy Spirit. And he asked me a question. He said, if you really believe everything that you've just written in that paper, then why are you trying? Why are you striving? And I think this really shows us something about God, that God is willing to go as far as we're willing to go with him. He's willing to ask the hard questions and really put us in that place. I didn't have an answer for that. So I knew that